Mitch Pardue came to in the belly of the whale, a vast, shadowy, cold cavern, as it seemed. He blinked, and the threatening curves around him resolved into something he recognized instantly as part of a spaceship. Not the shuttle, though, and not the space station he'd been on. He looked around cautiously. There on the deck nearby were a score of his fellows, most still slackly unconscious, one or two staring at him with expressions of fright.
Where are we?
He pushed himself up, and only then gathered his wits sufficiently to realize that he was dressed in a skimpy ship suit with no boots, with plastic shackles on his ankles. He felt his heart pounding before he identified the fright that shook him. He cleared his throat and stiffened in outrage and terror.
No.
He tried again, forming a soft word with his mouth, and no sound emerged. He looked around frantically. On one side of him, the bodies of his own crew, men he knew well, now more of them awake and mouthing silent protests. On the other, another clump of men he knew. Pete Robertson's bunch, he was sure, beginning to stir to attempt speech, to show in their faces the panic and rage he felt in his own. The troops that entered sometime later did not surprise him. He braced himself for torture or death. But after checking his shackles, they simply stood by the bulkhead, alert and dangerous, waiting for whatever would come. He should rally his men and jump them. He knew that, as he knew every word of scripture he'd been told to memorize. But lying there, mute and hobbled, he couldn't figure out how. He turned his head again and saw Terry watching him.
Get ready.
He tried to mouth it, but Terry just stared at him blankly. He nodded sharply. Terry shook his head. The women had been able to lip-speak to each other. Some of them had a hand language, too. Men should be able. He tried again, this time looking past Terry to Bob. Bob mouthed something he couldn't figure out in return and looked scared. Mitch was plumb disgusted. Giving up this way, what were they? He rolled over to attempt something with Pete, but one of the guards had moved and was making very clear gestures with his weapon. Mitch looked closer. Her weapon.
Stop it. No whispering, no mouthing.
The weapon in her hands was rock steady, and he didn't doubt the others would get him if he tried anything with her. Mitch looked up into dark eyes like chips of obsidian and didn't make a sound. Another of the soldiers walked up to the smoocher and deliberately kicked him in the balls. Another group of soldiers arrived. Mitch found himself suspended between two in space armor, propelled down a corridor to a large head.
Use it.
Mitch had urgent need, so did the others alongside him. From there, they were taken to a compartment with a long table set with meal packs. Mitch knew he shouldn't eat. He should starve himself rather than eat with these heathen. He tried to signal his team, figure out a way to stop them, but four of them were already tearing open the meal packs. He sat rigid, jaws clamped on his hunger, while the others ate. After a short time, two of them dragged him away to a small cubicle where he faced someone in a fancier uniform.
You won't eat?
Mitch shook his head.
Then we'll just have to feed you.
And in the humiliating struggle that followed, strong arms held him down while he was force-fed some thick liquid.
You do not have the option of suicide or resistance. You are going to cooperate with us. You have no choice.
After that, they took him back to a different compartment, a small, solitary cell. Mitch had, once or twice in his young days, traveled under a fake identity on Familius Registry ships. He had seen a few of the big commercial orbital stations. But nothing he had seen was like the interior of an elite warship. He wanted to despise it. He wanted to sneer at the exaggerated courtesy, the grave ritual, the polish and precision. But without a voice, he could do nothing but experience it. And in that experience, realize how foolishly he had misjudged his opponents. He had called down God's wrath on his people, and here was the instrument of that doom. Sleek, shining, perfectly disciplined, and utterly deadly. He wanted to defy them. He wanted to hate and defy and condemn and resist to his last breath. But he kept thinking of Prima and Secunda, his wives, his children, who would be someone else's, who might be forced out to work in someone's fields, who might be crying, unprotected, afraid because of him. He woke sweating, his own eyes burning. In the empty hours, staring at the blank walls, he saw deeper into himself than he ever had or wanted to. God was punishing him for his ambitions. That was only right, if he had done wrong.
But my family, why should they be punished?
His appetite disappeared, this time from no rebellion, but sadness. And his captors did not force him to eat this time.
We have only the smallest chance to get those children out alive. I know you want nothing to do with this Ranger Bowie, but unless he tells his wife to give them up, she won't. And he is the only one who can influence his brother, who has now inherited responsibility for his wives and children.
But it's ridiculous. Why can't we talk to her? I see no reason to negotiate with him. He's our prisoner. He's going to get a good, quick legal trial and the death sentence.
Do you want those children? Their families do. Their families will want to know why all these lives were expended for the Speaker's daughter and children of their own family left in slavery.
All right.
Mitch had not been to the bridge of a warship of this size. He was almost drawn out of his misery by the size, the complexity, the implications of power. His guards led him before a woman in night-dark uniform, with insignia that he recognized as an admiral's rank and bright-colored ribbons on her chest. And he stood before her, barefoot and voiceless, and wanted to see in her the very image of Satan, but could not.
You have a choice, Ranger Bowie. Your former prisoner, Hazel Takaris, insists that you truly love your wives and children.
Mitch nodded.
We are going to retrieve the other children you stole from the Elias Madero when you murdered their parents. However, the other men on the surface show no signs of cooperating with us. We are concerned that harm might come to your wives and children if they attempt to interfere with us, and we wish no harm to them. We want no child hurt, not so much as scratched. Do you understand?
He nodded again, though he wasn't sure he believed it.
But we will have those children returned to their families, whatever it takes. So, here is your choice. We can restore your voice for you to transmit a command to your family to release those children. Or, if you refuse, you can remain mute until your trial, however long that may be.
I might talk again. Have a man's voice again.
All around, he saw men and women listening as if they believed it.
Our landing craft are ready to launch. If they are fired on, they will return fire. If they are obstructed, they will fight through. And your people, sir, have nothing capable of resisting them. So it rests with you. Will you give these orders or not?
It was cooperating with the devil to take a woman's orders. A woman's soldier, an abomination of abominations. For a moment, he thought of the weapons hidden in the city, the chance that the other men might be able to launch them. Yet, he could almost feel against his cheek the soft cheeks of his daughters, could almost hear his children's laughter.
Kill them? Put them at risk?
He nodded.
Good. Take him to sickbay and have the treatment reversed. Then bring him back to the bridge.
He was a traitor, a backslider. All the way to sickbay, he trembled with the conflict inside. His guards said nothing to him, guiding him along with impersonal efficiency. In sickbay, a medic eased Mitch onto a table.
We have to put you to sleep briefly, just long enough to relax the throat muscles.